From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Sundown this coming Wednesday marks the beginning of the Jewish High Holy Days. Let me be the first to say Shana Tova to all of our Jewish friends. This program, State of Belief, is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit us at stateofbelief.com. Happy Labor Day weekend. As many of us try to pack a summer's worth of postponed fun into one last long weekend. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
According to the IRS, churches which don't pay taxes cannot participate in a campaign or endorse a politician.
In mid-August, the Commission on Accountability and Policy for Religious Organizations released a report recommending that the government lift the ban on candidate endorsements by tax-exempt religious organizations, including houses of worship. You probably will not be surprised that I've got some very serious concerns about this. There are major problems both for government and for religion when partisan politics can be preached behind sacred desks. On this week's show, I'll be talking to someone else who's got some very serious concerns about this. So serious, in fact, that he co-authored a comprehensive dissenting response to that report. Rabbi David Saperstein will be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Well, some people who live at the foot of New Jersey's Bayonne Bridge are not happy about an impending construction project on the span.
Several environmental and resident groups have filed a lawsuit against the Coast Guard and Port Authority of New York, New Jersey.
What caught my eye about this story is that one of the organizations is Green Faith, an interreligious environmental coalition headed by the Reverend Fletcher Harper, whom you met on this show back in February. And Reverend Harper will be with us later on this edition of State of Belief Radio. But first,
September 11th, Terry Jones is going to celebrate in his own unique way by burning not one Quran, but 2,998 Qurans.
You're probably sick of hearing about him by now, the Gainesville, Florida pastor who's always threatening to burn Qurans as some sort of anti-Islam statement. A few years back, he even got the attention of the federal government, which asked him to please not do that. Managing to occasionally make the headlines now and then, Terry Jones, actually more self-promoter than pastor, now says he'll mark the anniversary of 9/11 by publicly burning thousands of the holy books in Mulberry, Florida. Now, whether or not this ill-advised spectacle actually happens or not is yet to be seen. What is already clear is the response of affected communities. Widespread organizing in Mulberry is taking place to oppose the plan, and a Texas-based organization called the World Muslim Congress has moved its annual Unity Day USA event to Mulberry and scheduled that event for September 11th. And I'm glad to tell you that with me to talk about that decision is Mike Gauss, an enthusiastic public speaker on religious pluralism and head of the Muslim Congress. Mike, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's so good to be on this radio. I'm so glad you have a radio to promote interfaith and pluralism. I think that is the most needed thing, not only in America, every part of the world. And so good to be on your show.
Thank you. Mike, tell us about the World Muslim Congress.
World Muslim Congress came into being around 2002. It is committed to promote the pluralism embedded in Islam. World Muslim Congress came about as a response to 9/11 and 2001. Everybody was attacking Islam nonstop. So then I decided to create an organization that promotes the truth about Islam. to create a society where people can learn to live with each other without the fear of the other.
What kind of response are you getting to organizing the event to counter what Terry Jones is doing on 9/11 in Mulberry, Florida?
It's an amazing response. 3 days ago, 4 days ago, I knew nobody in Mulberry. Never. I never stopped. I stepped into Mulberry. I met people. I went and talked to the mayor of Mulberry, mayor of Lakeland. It was so much enthusiasm. It is like people wanted something right done. In 2 days, I was able to secure a place to hold the event. And got two mayors to go with it, and many clergy and faithful agreed, and there is a buzz going on. I'm very concerned about the not burning of Quran as much. Anybody can do anything. But my concern is the reaction to it by fellow Americans and Muslims around the world. I'm worried about the safety of Americans and our bases and our men and women serving us overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq. And that concern led me to put this event and reformat the event to address the issue. As you may find, whether it is Bible, Torah, Bhagavad Gita, or any holy book, which are all my dear books, there is always a guidance in there. Prophet Muhammad had said something very beautiful. He said, to overcome evil with good is the right thing to do. And to resist evil by evil is very evil. Mm-hmm. And that was strongly supported by the Quran. In Quran, chapter 41, verse 34 says, good and evil deeds are not equal. Repel evil with what is better. This is God saying to us. Then you will see that one who was once your enemy has become your dearest friend. Mm. And Mother Teresa, she had said, if you want to remove the enemy, if you want to bring peace, go talk to the enemy. And that's exactly what we are doing, Reverend. The response is good. And we are going through the scriptures. All religions, whether it is Jesus' message, these messages talk about creating societies where nobody has to live in fear of the other. This will all be at the website, UnityDayUSA.com,
yes.
UnityDayUSA.com, and WorldMuslimCongress.com.
Mike Gauss heads up the Muslim World Congress based in Dallas, Texas. He's a frequent voice of moderation on Muslim issues and is organizing a peaceful response to Pastor Terry Jones' threatened mass burning of Qurans in Florida on September 11th. Mike, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Sure.
Still to come on this week's show, the Reverend Fletcher Harper, Executive Director of Green Faith, that organization's just filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Coast Guard and the New York Port Authority. Rabbi David Saperstein is the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism here in Washington, D.C. He also is a member of an advisory panel that reports to the Commission on Accountability and Policy for Religious Organizations. And David authored a rebuttal to a recent commission report which had recommended ending the long-standing prohibition on endorsement of political candidates by churches and other tax-exempt organizations. I also should tell you that I have the pleasure of working with David in his capacity as a board member at Interfaith Alliance, as a colleague, and as a good friend. David Saperstein, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Always an honor to talk to you listeners.
Would you start by just summarizing how this commission came into existence and what it is for?
A few years ago, there was press attention to some way out of the box examples of clergy. I mean, some of this goes back to James Baker and Swaggart and folks like that, people who had very, very expensive homes and used the tax deduction of parsonage to reduce the entire value of those homes. And Senator Grassley decided that he wanted to put an end to some of the extravagance of this and thought about ending the parsonage altogether when so many clergy and so many denominations across the ideological, religious, political spectrums raised the alarm bell about that having a devastating impact on religious institutions in America. He withdrew the proposal and asked ECFA, a very respected group, the Evangelical Council on Fiscal Accountability, to set up a commission to look at a whole range of tax benefit issues that clergy and religious institutions have and to make recommendations about reform on that. The ECFA set up the commission. That's a very small group, I think generally out of the evangelical world, but not entirely. And then set up three distinguished panels of people from the public interest community, other nonprofits other than religious groups, from religious leaders and lawyers, each of which had somewhere between, 20 to 40 members of those panels, to look through all of these issues and to give recommendations, feedback to the commission that made the final determination. It was a very interactive process with the panels and a lot of feedback. The one question that was left aside was the question of political activity. And the first report on all parsonage and the tax exemptions was issued overwhelming consensus of the groups on all of the recommendations that were made. This year, they returned to the question of the political engagement. Here, there was time pressure from the Senate that created a truncated due process. It was not quite as interactive as the process before. And a few were not able to make the single meeting that they had weren't aware of the recommendation to end the ban on partisan political activity. And when we did, a number of us representing primarily the minority communities, the Jewish, Muslim, Hindu communities, raised the alarm bell, even though this is a concern shared by the Coalition to Preserve Religious Liberty that includes a number of mainline Protestant denominations as well.
I want to make sure our listeners understand what the current tax law is regarding political endorsements and tax-exempt status. Can you give just a succinct statement on that?
Religious groups can maintain their 501c3 tax exemption, allowing for tax-deductible gifts from their supporters and members and to be exempt from paying taxes and still talk about political issues and moral issues in our society, and can even engage in advocacy and lobbying so long as it's not a substantial part of their work. They recognize the prophetic witness of churches is an important part of what the religious community does. But they cannot spend one penny on partisan political activity. They cannot endorse candidates, they cannot oppose candidates or parties, and they cannot spend 1 cent on partisan political activity. So if they want to do it, they can do it without their tax exemption. They have a First Amendment right to say and do what they want, but all tax-exempt groups, not just religious groups, are banned from spending any money on partisan political activity.
Okay, so in mid-August, this commission released a lengthy report which argued for a significant shift in tax law that's been in place since the 1950s, and that shift would have allowed 501c3s, let's say churches, synagogues, temples,
and all other nonprofits,
and all other nonprofits to continue to receive tax exempt status, but also to make partisan political endorsements.
If tax exempt status, and don't forget the difference between a C3 and C4, both of which are tax exempt,
right,
is that a C4 can do more lobbying and get right up to the edge of partisan political activity, but contributors to them cannot deduct their contributions. With houses of worship and all other nonprofits, the C3 provision allows people to deduct gifts for them, which brings billions of dollars into libraries and museums and universities and all kinds of nonprofit groups that provide social services throughout America and to the religious communities of America.
The people who are for that particular change in tax law tend to say to people like us, you are denying the free speech provision of pastors and heads of organization and so forth. What are the basic arguments against this change?
Pastors, any kind of religious leader or a religious institution can do whatever it wants politically. They don't violate the law by doing something politically. They just can't do it and enjoy a tax-exempt status with tax-deductible gifts being able to be given to them. And what a minister or priest or rabbi, imam does outside of the context of their professional responsibilities as an individual, they can do whatever they want. Endorse people, support someone, just so long as you make it clear you're not doing it on behalf of the religious institution that enjoys a tax exemption. So you already have robust protections. But this would now allow the minister from the pulpit to endorse candidates and the church to distribute information about the endorsement of the candidate, so long as there wasn't money spent that otherwise wouldn't be spent. And this is problematic for a number of reasons. First, it's going to be very divisive to religious life. You know, we have enough religious battles in our congregations. You start having an Obama church and a Romney church and a Obama synagogue and an Obama museum and a, you know, pro-Romney museum to divide the nonprofit communities of America along partisan political lines, arguably the most tendentious, divisive aspect of American life today, is a very, very dangerous part. Think about two candidates being a member of the same church, and a church endorses one against the other one. Think that what we would do and the way it would divide a church, and think how impassioned people get to listen to the minister endorsing a particular candidate. You're going to have people getting up in the middle of sermons and interrupting and arguing. It is the last thing that we need at this time. Yeah. The other huge flaw of this is that because tax-deductible money can be given, you can see millions of dollars given as an incentive to churches and ministers to endorse or oppose candidates, and they can do as much as they want to do so long as there's not a special expenditure, really. If they put it in their weekly newsletter, if they do it in the sermon, if they do it at a public forum that they would hold otherwise, they would be allowed to do as much as they wanted to do. You think of people who poured millions and millions of dollars into the campaigns once the Citizens United ruling came through. And you're going to have millions of dollars that are going to be spent for political advertisements, for all kinds of other things, as part of the ongoing publications and communications of churches. What a disaster for good elections in America, and what a disaster for the religious community of America.
David, there's clearly a well-organized campaign against the endorsement ban, as reflected in years of so-called pulpit Sunday events trying to goad the IRS into action that can be used to try to end the ban. How do you see those efforts reflected in the commission's actions, if at all? And does this politically volatile environment make our position more difficult to defend?
I think the converse is of greater concern, that the groups like the Alliance Defense Fund and the groups of the network of churches who have been challenging the IRS's ban on this will take this report as a stamp of legitimacy, having three panels of very distinguished people giving their stamp of approval to this through the commission that processed the panel recommendations. They're going to say, you see, this is not just a group of people on the fringes. This is as mainstream as you can get in American religious and legal life. And look, they back our position about it. So I think that that's harmful. So one of the reasons when we realized what was happening, we wanted to put a marker down and indicate, wait a minute, this is far more complicated than that. You know, we still have many of the national religious denominations in this country that are strongly opposed to this, think it would be devastating for religion. But I imagine that this will fuel their activities, and they'll use it to recruit other people to be involved. And it is puzzling why the IRS has not acted against any of these churches. I understand why they wouldn't want to act against all of them. That would be playing into their hands, you know, persecuting people for what they've done. They do it on one Sunday and doesn't feel like it has a huge impact. But I'm not sure why they've allowed this to go as long as they have without acting. And I think that that exacerbated is one of the rationales that the commission used to say, we have to speak on this because clearly the system is broken. These people are blatantly violating law. The IRS is not enforcing the law at all. We need something that everyone can live with better. I applaud the motivation. I applaud the creativity of the commissioners. They had other recommendations we were more comfortable with. I think this piece of it just was dead wrong.
I remember several years ago testifying in a congressional hearing on this, and the IRS was there and said that they simply don't have enough personnel to ferret out where all the problem is. But now they have the very people who want to do this saying, we are the problem. Come and get us.
That's
and,
right.
And then they're not doing it.
I don't understand that. And I remember your testimony, and deeply appreciated the op-ed at this point that was very powerful that you and Rabbi Schoenfeld did.
Well, thanks. Do you know whether or not Senator Grassley shares some of your concerns?
I don't know the answer to that, and we're going to try to get into speak to him about it directly. We're reaching out to other senators, trying to get a marker down on this early on so that people have some context to see the recommendation when it comes out and know how many religious organizations are opposed to this particular recommendation. We'd much rather have the Senate focus on some of the other recommendations mm-hmm. that really
right.
are aimed at cleaning up some of the confusion and setting clearer standards so that churches don't inadvertently violate the existing rules simply because they don't understand them.
David, is there a role for our listeners in this debate?
You know, I would assume that in communities across the country and churches across the country, the growing attention to the issue of should the ban be lifted, produced not just by this report, but more by the churches that are publicly challenging the IRS, will tempt other churches in the community of your listeners to begin to question whether or not they ought to do it. If it happens in your church, just know there's plenty of information available, our minority report being one of them, but there's plenty of information that's available through Interfaith Alliance or any of the groups that work collegially with Interfaith Alliance to let people know what the dangers are of this and make sure your church doesn't begin to go down that path, and if others in your community do, to politely raise in newspapers or in personal conversation with folks some of the repercussions are going down. They're opening up a Pandora's box that is really going to be bad. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, we ask and get a lot of exemptions that nobody else gets, the mm-hmm. religious community, because only in the Constitution, only religion has an establishment clause. Mm-hmm. We're free of all kinds of things that make life much easier and straightforward for the churches of America so that you don't have to worry about government rules, regulations, monitoring, auditing that can be very costly and very invasive to our religious freedom.
Yeah.
If you get involved in partisan political activity, you're begging the government to come in and regulate it. How can they not regulate electoral activity? And once they do that and start looking, how much money do you spend? Is this extra money? Is it overhead? You're opening up a whole Pandora's box of new lawsuits, new IRS rules and regulations that are going to be exceedingly burdensome to us. And I think that the commission just kind of missed the boat on that in thinking they were cleaning it up. They've instead opened up a Pandora's box that we will rule.
David, you've been around Capitol Hill doing this kind of work longer than almost any of us. Do you have a guess as to where this may go?
A clean up and down vote on this, we would prevail. When Representative Walter Jones, a man I admire in many regards, introduced a bill to do this several times on the House side, we were able to beat it down solidly. I suspect on an up and down vote, we will do well. If this gets tossed in to a whole revamping of tax exemptions and a revamping of the tax code, and this is one small piece of it, it might turn out to be very hard to stop. So it kind of depends where, you know, how many Democratic senators are willing to go with those in the Republican Party who want to support the more conservative evangelical voices calling for these bans to be lifted, knowing that most of those particular voices support their candidates. It just depends how many Democrats will join Republicans on this. I think we can stop it, even as part of a larger bill, but it will be very, very close. And that requires State of Belief listeners to be more vigilant about this. And if the time comes where they see this going and they share our concerns as represented in this report, then I really hope they will vigorously reach out and get their religious leaders to reach out to senators to tell them, don't do this. This is an idea that's bad for religion in America, bad for free elections in America, and bad for the commonweal of America because of its divisive impact on our churches and communities.
David Saperstein is the director of the Religious Action Center of Reform Judaism and a member of an advisory panel that reports to the Commission on Accountability and Policy for Religious Organizations. He's just co-authored a rebuttal to the recent commission report, which had called for ending the ban on political endorsements from churches and other tax-exempt organizations. You'll find links to this report. You'll find David's response, and you'll find my own thoughts on the matter at stateofbelief.com. David, as always, thank you for taking time to be with us and helping us better understand this on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you. Well, and since it's that time of year in the Jewish community, let me wish everyone a sweet and healthy and fulfilling Jewish New Year.
When the Reverend Fletcher Harper was first with us back in February, he introduced you to his work as executive director of Green Faith, an interreligious coalition of partners for the environment. We talked then about the kind of work such a coalition could take on, and it's time now to check in and see how that work is going. And with that, I'm happy to welcome Fletcher Harper back to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Fletcher.
It's great to be with you.
So I hear there's a lawsuit underway. Tell us about what's going on.
Sure. Well, at ports around the country, shipping ports, the air pollution problems are severe. The ports are responsible for enormous amounts of commercial activity, and along that, with that comes a great deal of air pollution. And that air pollution makes the people who live around the ports, who are in the vast majority of cases people who are poor and people of color, it makes those people sick. It gives them a variety of respiratory illnesses, and those problems are serious. Most recently in Ports Newark and Elizabeth, and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is planning to raise a bridge that will allow enormous new vessels to come into the ports. And they're doing that in a manner that's going to increase the air pollution in the area, but they're not planning to do anything to address that air pollution. And that's essentially the rationale behind the litigation.
So how did Green Faith get involved in this? Had you had interaction with the Port Authority and they didn't pay attention? Or just tell us how it all transpired.
Over the last 4 years, Green Faith has worked as part of a group called the Coalition for Healthy Ports, which has reached out on numerous occasions to the Port Authority to try to find ways to reduce the port-related air pollution. And unfortunately, the Port Authority has been very slow to respond, and in most cases has not responded meaningfully at all. And when the plans were submitted by the Port Authority to raise the bridge, the Bayonne Bridge, those plans failed to address the increased air pollution. And so we reached out, expressed concern, were able to organize a public hearing on the topic at which numerous community representatives expressed concern. We found out later that the Environmental Protection Agency had raised exactly the same types of concerns that we were raising, but it all seemed to fall on deaf ears. And so based on that, we were put in a position where the only thing we could do to try to protect the health of the community was to go to court.
Fletcher, I want to ask you a question. It's really kind of an overarching question, though it relates to this specific initiative. What do you think a religiously oriented environmental coalition brings to this kind of campaign that other types of groups may not bring?
I think a couple of things. One is a witness that this is beyond being an economic or environmental issue, that it is at its core a moral issue. That a port like Port Newark or Port Elizabeth, one of the biggest and wealthiest ports in the country, simply shouldn't be able to operate in a way that disregards the health and well-being of the most vulnerable communities in the region. And so I think there's an explicit moral voice that is brought to the table. And I think there's also a sort of spiritual and religious dimension to this, which is to recognize that to operate commercial activities in a way that degrades the environment and also hurts people, that there's a desecration involved. And so I think that by having an explicitly religious organization associated with these activities, it puts those two issues sort of right on the table as part of the rationale of the suit itself.
I understand that, and I want to do one follow-up question related to this. Do you find, when that is your emphasis, do you find any special challenges then to working with the secular groups that are also a part of this court challenge?
We really have not. We've been very fortunate to be partners with local community groups, such as the Ironbound Community Corporation, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the New Jersey Environmental Federation, a coalition of labor and community and environmental organizations, which share very similar concerns about the health and well-being of the community and the fact that these are solvable problems, and it's really just a choice of very powerful actors not to solve them. So while we may use slightly more explicitly religious language, we find that we can make common cause on a deep and compelling number of levels.
I guess I'm interested in whether or not when you're dealing with someone like the Port Authority, whether they consider the moral perspective that you bring to it an important perspective in the conversation.
It's a good question, and it's very hard to tell, frankly.
Right.
The Port Authority is large. It appears very clearly to me that their primary interest is in facilitating as much commercial activity through the port as possible without a commensurate level of concern for the impact of their port's operations on the surrounding community. The port generates an enormous amount of economic activity, and it's very clear that it would be feasible to reduce the air pollution related to the port's activities to a greater degree that's being done without causing any major economic harm. And it's just bad that that's not happening.
Reverend Fletcher Harper came on this show back in February and talked about the launch of Green Faith and some of its objectives, like you're hearing discussed right here. Fletcher, I'd like for you to give our listeners information on how they can be in touch with Green Faith. Give that information, please.
Sure. On the web, you can find our website at greenfaith.org. That's green like the color green and faith like faith in God, all in one word, .org. If you search for us under Green Faith on Facebook, you'll find us there. And on Twitter, we're at Green Faith World. That's our handle, at Green Faith World. There's contact information on the website, and if folks have questions about any of our programs, I hope they'll reach right out to me because I'd love to hear from them.
What other initiatives are underway or on the horizon for Green Faith?
We've launched a campaign to support faith-based efforts around fossil fuel divestment and reinvestment in a clean energy future. Our sense is that with efforts to support climate change legislation, unfortunately dead in the water, that it's really important now for faith communities to take the next step, which is to make it clear that they'll no longer be willing to profit from the operation of fossil fuel companies, and at the same time, look to find ways to support the development of the renewable energy, clean energy economy that we desperately need. So we've been working with representatives of seven or eight different denominations on that, and see a growing level of interest around the country. We're also in the early stages of exploring the possibility of creating a green certification program designed specifically for theological seminaries. The idea being that there's no better way to transform the next generation of clergy into environmental leaders than to give them exposure to to good education and training in the seminary level. That's at a very early planning stage, but we're hopeful about that. So those are two of our most ambitious new programs.
The Reverend Fletcher Harper is Executive Director of Green Faith and Interreligious Coalition of Partners for the Environment. The group's one of many that are challenging the U.S. Coast Guard, New York Port Authority in court over environmental practices in the New York metropolitan region. Thanks again for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for your work and leadership, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donation of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to the show today. We'll use it wisely, I promise, to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem even to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcast. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please, throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. As always, I encourage you to tell other people about the show. We like to expand this conversation that's going on and encourage others to contribute to it as well as to listen to our contribution. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.